today, the very different realities that countries are facing as they continue to fight coronavirus. Six months ago, as cases of coronavirus were rapidly increasing, the world began to register it as an urgent threat. Many countries hoped that imposing lockdowns would slow the course of COVID-19 and allow people to gradually go back to normal life. But that is not how things have panned out.
According to the World Health Organization, it's accelerating faster than ever. So we're in this uniquely difficult and I think frustrating stage where the initial shock of the pandemic has subsided, but there's not really a clear end in sight.
From Portugal to Pakistan, The Guardian's international correspondent Michael Safi has looked at the very different ways that countries have been affected by the virus and the impact this is having on the lives of people there. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how the world is living with coronavirus, 6 months on. You've been interviewing people around the world about living with coronavirus. Mm. And from those conversations, how have you found countries divide in terms of the ways they're experiencing COVID?
These aren't scientific categories, but it seemed to me that there were like four broad stages. One was countries like Spain or Italy that were hit hard by the virus in February and went into lockdown and are now trying to, I guess, negotiate with it, trying to see how much normal life is possible while this virus is around. Then there were countries like the US, Brazil, India, who never really flattened their curve, and they've just seen the virus keep spreading and spreading and finding new communities to infect. I also looked at poorer countries like Pakistan, who said from the beginning, we can't afford to fight this like others. Total lockdowns for months would kill more people than the virus from things like starvation and other diseases. And finally, there was a very small handful of countries that did almost everything right, and they've more or less eliminated the virus, but they're sealed off from the world.
Let's start with that first category, countries that successfully bent the curve and are now working out how to live with the virus. Who falls into that group?
Well, there's a few countries in that category, but I think the most prominent are in Europe. So Spain, Italy, France, Greece, countries in the Balkans and Eastern Europe. And in particular, I zoomed in on the case of Portugal.
In Portugal, the number of coronavirus cases per capita is vastly lower than that in neighbouring Spain.
It rolled out a great testing regime, it imposed a pretty effective lockdown, and it managed to both keep its curve low and then begin bending it quickly.
So at what point did the country begin easing that lockdown?
It was in early May that Portugal gradually started to ease those restrictions.
Home is where the lockdown has kept many of us for the past 2 months, but not so in Portugal, where this weekend was the first when it was not forbidden to be on the beach.
First, they opened local shops, hairdressers, they allowed people to gather in groups of less than 10, and then every fortnight for a few weeks, they would allow more and more to happen. I heard a bit about the experience of Julia Georgalis, who's a British woman living in Lisbon, who's the part owner of a restaurant.
Kind of like one day we woke up and then our staff kind of didn't want to come to work. And that's when it sort of hit that, oh my gosh, this is actually a thing.
And she talked about these complicated, constantly shifting rules. So, for example, people would have to wear masks into the restaurant, but they could take them off at the table. But then if they wanted to go to the bathroom, the mask would have to come back on.
And because we're so small, we were so small to begin with, reducing the capacity by so much and not having an outdoor space wouldn't have worked for us.
It would have been really difficult for us. Definitely.
Each day it's this process of figuring out, okay, what are the rules today? What are the new restrictions? And how do we try to adapt to that so that we can stay in business? It's complicated.
How successful has this reopening been for the country?
Well, there hasn't been another huge outbreak, but if you look at the figures, they're still finding cases. It's just that the growth isn't exponential. So there's been a couple of big outbreaks, especially in working class neighbourhoods, and about 700,000 people were put under lockdown for a bit of June and July.
And in Portugal, some lockdown measures are being reimposed in the capital after a spike of new cases.
the virus otherwise has sort of simmered away. You know, they're finding a few low 100 cases each day, but it hasn't boiled over in the way that we saw in Italy or Spain in March.
Spain now, where there has been a big increase in the number of coronavirus deaths.
Or in the way that we're beginning to see again in parts of Europe.
France has the world's seventh highest death toll from COVID-19. And whilst it had looked like the spread of the virus had been brought under control, the French authorities reported 7,000 new cases during the course of the past week.
The country sounds like it has avoided the worst in terms of the impact of the virus on people's lives. But what about financially?
It's hit the country really badly. So about one in five Portuguese workers have been laid off since the beginning of the pandemic. And the IMF says that the country's economy will contract by 8% GDP this year, which is above the global average.
Only 854 people have died so far, a number the authorities credit to social compliance with lockdown measures. But the country's tourism and export-based economy is taking a serious beating.
As you've said, other countries in Europe that felt they had the virus under control are now beginning to see a surge in cases. What do you take from this situation?
Well, if the past few weeks have been an experiment in how much normal life the virus permits, you'd have to say not that much. I mean, we're seeing what epidemiologists have been telling us would happen all the time, which is that the more we mix, the more activity and travel that goes on, the more this virus is going to spread. It's inevitable. And that's what we're seeing. So a lot of these countries that bent the curve early now find themselves having to find a kind of agonizing balance between letting societies and economies function and, on the other hand, making sure that this virus circulates at a level that is somewhat under control.
As some countries are experiencing a second wave, others are still struggling to even escape the first. And I think, to some extent, the UK would fit into this category. But I think the most notable example at the moment is the US, which currently has the highest COVID death rate in the world. You decided to focus on one state in particular, Arizona. Why is that?
Well, around the time that I began planning this story, Arizona had the misfortune of being the place with the most deaths per person of any U.S. state.
There is news from the state of Arizona that the highest single-day death toll took place yesterday, 33 Arizonans.
There was a debate at the time about whether and how you could send kids to school in that kind of environment. And so I thought a teacher in a hotspot like Arizona would be a good person to find because they're at the very heart of this dilemma. They're the ones whose livelihoods are being weighed here.
COVID is it's a fascinating day-to-day experiment, experience, maybe not an experiment per se, but an experience.
So I was introduced to a teacher named Robin Neely, who teaches high school, grades 6 to 12. So that's kids aged roughly 12, 13, up to sort of 17 or 18.
I didn't know anyone who had it personally, but at this point, I've got a good handful of friends who tested positive. No one that I know personally has died, although I believe we just lost our fourth teacher to COVID here in Arizona. So that is a stressful thing when we're looking at whether or not to open schools to in-person learning or if we're going to...
The atmosphere in Phoenix at the moment, he said, was pretty anxious. I mean, it's a place where people know the virus is circulating. It's just out there. And he says that the state hasn't done enough testing. Its contact tracing capabilities are not good enough.
And so we're still shadowboxing. We're still fighting a ghost. We don't know where the thing is.
He has massively scaled down the amount of time he spends out of his house. When he meets with people, he tries to make very certain they keep a distance, they don't touch each other. It's in the place, I guess, that many European countries were about 6 months ago.
And how does he feel about how people in the state are responding to COVID?
He felt that Americans on both sides of the political divide had let their partisanship cloud their judgment over this thing.
My concern primarily, and this is just coming as a person, is how I'm seeing the politicization of it taking precedence in people's perception over its nature as a virus. Does that make sense?
I felt like it had shaken his faith a little bit. And he just sounded, I guess, pretty bereft, I think, that the community was willing to debate whether or not he goes and does something where there's a huge risk of his life being threatened.
It's a really hard choice. I have no intention and no desire to leave the job I have. So much that I haven't even really fully walked down that road. I've actually considered the implications of what if I get sick and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, I'm a 33-year-old and I'm an asthmatic, so that may not go well. And what could that mean for community at large? I spent more time actually considering.
I guess the good news for him is that Arizona's governor has said that school districts themselves can decide when their students come back to school in person. And if they don't feel safe enough, then they can continue doing online learning when school does resume in the state.
The US is really struggling to battle with COVID, but it's not the only country that is at the moment. And I know from previous Today in Focus episodes that the virus is still very prevalent in Brazil and India. Why is it, Michael, that some countries are really struggling to flatten the first curve?
In the US, there have been many failures, including the inability to get a functioning test going for nearly a month after the outbreak started to grow in the country. In India, we've seen attempts to impose a lockdown to do social distancing, but it hasn't really worked. It's almost impossible in a country that's so crowded. And parts of Brazil, similarly with states in the US, were accused of relaxing quarantines too early, whether because they didn't take the virus seriously enough or were concerned about the economic impact. And if we've learned anything about responding to coronavirus, it's that time matters. If you impose restrictions a week too late or a month too late, that's going to have huge consequences in terms of the outbreak that you have.
And where do countries like these go from here, do you think, Michael?
I guess it's a long struggle for many of these countries to try to get their arms around this virus. And the alternative is that it will just continue to grow and find new vulnerable populations to infect. And the number of infections will just get larger and larger and larger.
COVID-19 knows no bounds, and some of the most vulnerable to the coronavirus are Native Americans. The president of the Navajo Nation, which covers ground in Arizona and New Mexico, says COVID-19 cases and deaths are growing at a very alarming rate.
One interesting thing about the outbreak in the U.S., at least in the last month or so, is that the mortality rate compared to what we were seeing in March is said to be much, much lower. And so there is some good news here, and that's that we do appear to be getting much, much better at treating coronavirus. You know, we have some reasonably effective treatments available. And so as a result, far fewer people are actually dying from this virus than they were 6 months ago.
We've talked about relatively wealthy countries and their experience of the virus so far. But how has COVID-19 impacted on developing nations, particularly ones that are perhaps already struggling with humanitarian crises and poor healthcare?
Pakistan is one of the most prominent among developing countries who have, you know, more or less thrown their hands up in the face of this virus. They've said that people should wear masks. They've declared what they call smart lockdowns in local hotspots. But leaders such as the Prime Minister Imran Khan have been pretty upfront from the start that in a country without a decent welfare system and where one in four people live in poverty, quarantine and lockdown will kill more people than this virus.
In the developing world, apart from containing the virus and dealing with the economic crisis, our biggest worry now is people dying of hunger.
And so for the most part, they just haven't done it. They've sort of let the country operate as it was and suggested to people to take precautions.
And who did you speak to when you were looking into Pakistan?
One of the people I talked to was a guy called Zulkarnain Mengal, and he's an accountant in the Pakistani city of Quetta. And he told me that he had watched over the past few months one member of his family after another become sick. And eventually, he started showing symptoms too. Nobody in his family was ever tested for it. And that was because having COVID-19 is something that's very stigmatized. Like, nobody wants to be seen to have it. And in fact, one of his uncles said to him that if anyone in our family gets tested, you know, they're going to have to go through me because I don't want this thing bringing like shame on our family.
That's interesting. So there is a real stigma around it. And do we know how this impacts on the accurate reporting of cases in the country?
Pakistan's official figures are about 277,000 cases and less than 6,000 deaths. And when you talk to doctors in the country, they say that they're not quite sure that that's exactly right and that the reduction in recent weeks might have more to do with the reduction in testing than in the virus actually petering out in the country.
Do we have any sense of then of how many people are dying from COVID?
It's hard to say for sure. I mean, I talked to a doctor in Quetta. He's the head of the pulmonology department at one of the hospitals in the city that's dealing with COVID patients. And he said that, you know, anecdotally, when he talks to gravediggers, they say that they're burying 8 or 9 people a day when they used to bury just 1 or 2 people. On the other hand, he says that his hospital is not overwhelmed with cases. And when he talks to other doctors in the country, they say things have quieted down. And so that was a mystery. And I spoke to a couple of experts about that. And they made the point to me that poor countries were expected to be absolutely smashed by the coronavirus. However, we haven't really seen that. Not in Pakistan. And I mean, Nigeria, for example, is the most populous country in Africa.
An estimated population of 21 million people are being told to stay indoors. But unlike the rest of the world, time has allowed Nigeria to prepare. It's been nearly 4 weeks since the first case was confirmed, and so far there have been less than 140.
It's recorded about 800 deaths. Now, definitely there will be some underreporting, but these epidemiologists I talked to said that if there were hundreds and thousands of people dying, there would be some indication of it. And so people have been trying to think about why that might be, and they've given different reasons. One is that many developing countries, including Pakistan, have disproportionately young populations. They have low obesity rates. Many countries, especially in West Africa, they're pretty battle-hardened. I mean, they're used to dealing with things like cholera, measles, with successive rounds of Ebola. And so, yes, they have limited resources, but they know how to use those limited resources to fight diseases. Countries like Uganda, like Rwanda, are handling this pretty well. And so it turns out they actually have a bit to teach wealthier countries.
In general, then, how has the virus impacted on developing countries economically?
Well, it looks like countries like Pakistan, even having avoided the most stringent lockdowns, will not avoid the economic hit of this virus. Global agencies tell us that this will be the first year since 1998 in which global poverty will increase. Something like more than 68 million people will be pushed under that benchmark of living on $1.90 a day.
Coming up, what it's like to live in a country where coronavirus has been almost entirely eliminated. Finally, Michael, you have looked at countries where there were hardly any cases, and you didn't have to go any very far for that because that includes where you're based, in Jordan. How have they been so successful in containing the outbreak?
Well, they credit their success to a strategy that put public health first above any economic considerations. So what they did was very, very quickly seal their borders, and they imposed one of the harshest lockdowns in the world. They say that by acting so quickly and in such a draconian way, they managed to jump on the cases that were here, deal with them, while not allowing any new cases into the country. Jordanians were pretty happy with the result because if you look at Amman now, it's a strange little oasis in a very weird world. I mean, things are back to normal here. Life has kind of gone back to the way it was before the virus, except for the fact that the border is shut.
How many people have lost their lives to COVID?
So Jordan has had just over 1,000 cases, and 11 total deaths. I spoke to the Jordanian Prime Minister about this.
Hello, sir.
How are you?
Are we shaking hands?
Yes, sure.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Yeah. It's become the very awkward question now whenever you meet someone. Do you put your hand out? Do you not?
Please,
thank you very much.
He said that the country's health system could absorb maximum 150, 200 cases a day. That's the capacity of the country's healthcare system. And the worst case scenario they were planning for was 600 new cases a day. As it happened, the worst day was 40 cases.
Gosh, I mean, 11 deaths to us here in the UK, I mean, that is just a startlingly low figure. The Jordanian Prime Minister must feel very confident about that result.
He does. You know, being a reporter, I've kind of called around, I've spoken to labs and people who work in this space, and they say it checks out. Like, if this were out there, if this were spreading, we would probably know about it. We'd see some evidence of it, and that just isn't there. So it looks like they can credibly claim to have defeated this thing for now.
So has the Jordanian economy also avoided the hit that others around the world have taken in recent months?
Unfortunately, it hasn't. So Jordan's unemployment rate was estimated at about 20% before this crisis. That's very high. Now a Labour analyst has claimed it could go as high as 30%. On the other hand, the Jordanian Prime Minister says that because the country weathered COVID so well, it was able to attract investment that might have gone elsewhere. So a lot of garment manufacturers, for example, felt that they couldn't safely work in Pakistan or Bangladesh. And so they shifted their orders to Jordan, where they knew that the industry was up and running and it was safe.
In spite of all the mess that COVID created economically, what was very pleasantly surprising is that investments kept coming into Jordan. Exports went up. It indicates how much stability is worth in the world today.
That's how Jordan is going to sell itself now. It's going to be a safe COVID destination. It'll be an island of stability in an unstable world.
And it wants to maintain that stability. Jordan was due to reopen its airports today to a few selected countries with low transmission rates like Canada and Cyprus, but this has now been delayed. Clearly, the Prime Minister Omar Razaz has apprehensions about opening up Jordan.
He said that, you know, looking around the region, you've got Saudi Arabia next door, terrible outbreak, Israel, another big outbreak, Syria, where we have no idea really what's going on. He said, you know, he would be foolish not to expect there's going to be a second wave. And all the planning is that there may be one.
Saying, okay, when is the, not if, when is the next wave going to hit?
But he said the country is ready. They've fortified the health system. They've got these different safety regimes in place.
Around you in the region, and knowing that you have, you know, a million Jordanians who are living overseas who are saying, we want to go come back because
a vaccine might be 6, probably 9, maybe even more months away. The country cannot afford to just stay sealed off from the world. At some point, they're going to have to make the same calculations as a country like Portugal. They'll have to figure out how they can live with this virus.
You know, it is very awkward because I was very glad that we actually, in Jordan, we stopped the kissing.
Yes.
And yes. And eventually we did stop the... But just in the last week,
it
came back. So
yeah.
It's hard to maintain that discipline when your numbers are zero.
I guess inside the country. People are feeling relaxed,
Yeah, which is good but dangerous.
But it struck me that if cases do grow here, it's going to be a stretch for people. It's going to be a real labor to relearn all of these habits, to sort of learn again, to see risk everywhere. Because, you know, for the last few weeks, it's been the opposite. People have been actually learning to relax and, you know, embracing that very enthusiastically.
Michael, at the end of your reporting, what have you concluded? Where is the world at with COVID-19 right now?
A lot of the experts I spoke to, including Alexandra Phelan, she's an associate professor at Georgetown Center for Global Health and Security. She said it's becoming evident now that actually this is more of an ultra marathon, that the original timelines that were set out for the virus have been extended. And that's partly because so many countries have been fighting this on their own. They've been fighting this as countries. And so you end up with discrepancies where one country in Europe can have a COVID regime and another next door can have a totally different one. And if they open their borders to each other, the virus will exploit those differences. Similarly, when a vaccine is found or when several vaccines are found, what we're seeing is countries fighting each other for doses of this stuff. It doesn't matter if all of the US has the vaccine or all of the UK has the vaccine. If people in Sierra Leone or Nigeria or Pakistan don't have it, because in the end, it's one planet. People will travel. They'll still interact. What needs to happen to drastically shrink the timeline of this pandemic is for countries to begin to work together. Otherwise, it will go a lot longer than it needs to.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Michael Safi. Read his story about coronavirus 6 months on at theguardian.com. Well, you should also go back and listen to the amazing podcast he made with us a few weeks ago about how Jordan ended up with the highest smoking rates in the world. A week after Michael wrote about this, Jordan introduced a ban on smoking and vaping indoors, a huge change for the country. Today's episode was produced by Serena Barker-Singh and sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.